This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
That is, you've come to the right place. This is Pro Wrestling Love, Volume 13, right here on the Place to Be Nation Network. I am Marty Sleaze, your host, Superstar Sleaze on Twitter and on the Pro Wrestling Only Forum. I am joined today by Matt, who is Cap on the Pro Wrestling Only Forums. He is Markout Mountain Matt on Twitter. We are discussing the top 25 greatest shoot style matches to take place in Japan. And we are on numbers 15 through number 11, getting close to that top 10. And we just want to make sure that everyone is aware that we are both members of the GWE Project at freeforums.net. Every year we ballot the top 100 greatest matches of all time. Doesn't matter where they take place, doesn't matter what time they take place, as long as there's film of it. And you can make sure that we can all see the film. We are willing to accept any nominations and make your case for the greatest matches of all time. We welcome all people to participate. Once again, it is gweproject.freeforums.net. And now to our number 15 through 11 greatest shoot style matches to take place in Japan. And we're back. It's Pro Wrestling Love, episode 13, and we're doing part 3 of the greatest Japanese shoot-style matches of all time right here on the Place to Be Nation. I am scaling Markout Mountain once again with my main man from Amsterdam as I continue to steal all of Stone Cold Steve Austin's catchphrases. Matt. Matt, what's going on, my mountaineer?
You know, living the dream, watching wrestling in the middle of a pandemic, man.
That's right, brother. Long time no talk. Anything new in the past week or two weeks?
It's crazy. Nothing new. Literally nothing new in my life over a two-week span.
All right. That's crazy, too. I think I've gone to the bathroom once in those 2 weeks. All right. So Matt is, of course, Cap on Pro Wrestling Only. I'm Superstar Sleaze on Pro Wrestling Only and on Twitter. I don't know if I said that in the last two episodes, but I am. And he is Markout Mountain on the Twitter. We are both not only at Pro Wrestling Only, but we are at G as in greatest, W as in wrestling, E as in ever, project.freeforums.net. Join. We do the greatest match of ever balloting every year. We did it in 2019. We did it in 2020. Make your voices heard. It is your... You know, you need to do it. It's a good thing
for
your
God-given right.
It's your God-given right. This is an unalienable right. Don't let it go to waste. And let us know what you think the greatest match of all time is. So we're here to the purposes to expose people to great wrestling and also to make it a little bit easier by creating small lists of by breaking it down into bite-sized pieces, taking different promotions, and then once you have the little list, you can piece together into one big list. So we are talking about the top 25 shoot-style matches of all time from Japan. We have done 25 through 16 at this point, and we will do 15 through 11 now. I will start, and I am very excited because, as you know, we've been talking about Volkan in the last episode, and I said, oh, you know, I was gushing over him. Big man crush. But we have not talked about somebody who I think I love even more than Fujiwara. You know what? Jeff Van Gundy made this great point once. Why do we have to do comparisons? It means one thing is less than the other. Why can't both things be great? I'm not going to compare. I love them both equally. It's Yoshiaki Fujiwara versus Kazu Yamazaki from UWF Reborn, July 24th, 1989.
I do not have this. I don't know that I've seen this. Unless I might have seen, I went on a Fujiwara tear a while back and I didn't rate everything that I was watching or take notes on everything I was watching. So I might have seen this. Maybe it'll jog my memory when you talk about it, but I don't have it.
Fujiwara is the boss. He's the OG.
Best. He's the best. He's the
motherfucking man. He's who I want to be when I grow up.
Oh, he stole my line.
you were going to say it. I love Fujiwara. This is a big Segunda Kaita match. Segunda Kaita is like Phil Schneider, yeah. Eric R., Matt D. I think there might be another person who runs that blog. It's a great blog. People should check it out. Will Good Helmet, the guy from Texas who's the man, who I actually talked to on Christmas. We spent Christmas together. We were both alone on Christmas. We had a phone call. It was great. I saw Dick Togo with Will. He's a good brother. Anyways, Will has this line. I'm going to steal it. Well, it's not true for me, but he often says that Phil Schneider is the person who's introduced him to the most great wrestling he's ever experienced. So for me, PWO in general, that's true for me. But for Will, it's Phil Schneider. So Segunda Kaita, it's a great place. Matt D's awesome. I have nothing but love for Matt D. We look at wrestling in two usually very different ways, but I love how much thought he puts into his analysis of wrestling. That being said, so Segunda Kaita tends to be a very pro Fujiwara place. And I think this is one of their ones that they really stumped for. So if you haven't watched it, or if you haven't, just don't remember it. I would highly recommend checking it out. So here's the thing. So I kind of have this general belief that shoot style should be about 15 to 20 minutes, mostly because there's only so many toe holds and double wrist locks and arm bars you can kind of do. And I think it's just a perfect amount of time for the story to kind of play out. This match goes 30. And I was kind of like, I like Yamazaki. My favorite Yamazaki match is with Hashimoto. It's a completely pro-style match. And Yamazaki's, like, very fine. He's very okay. Good kicker. But I was like, 30 minutes with Yamazaki. And then, you know what? To steal a line from Bret the Hitman Hart, who am I to doubt Yoshiaki Fujiwara, baby? Because this is a stellar match. The front half, first 15 minutes, is fun. We don't usually use the word fun to describe shoot style, but this is fun with a capital F, baby. And one of the things that I liked about the most is, like, Yamazaki kind of hits this, like, dainty kick to the midsection. It's not, like, dainty because he was, like, it was just kind of, maybe it was, like, a check kick, or it was just, like, he wasn't really throwing it full force type thing, maybe just to keep him at bay. And Fujiwara feigns being knocked down for a 9 count on this, like, little kick, only to get up and look at him with, like, such contempt. Like, who are you to think that you knocked me down for a 9 count with that little bitch kick? And it's like, that's great. Fujiwara is great luring people into the corner and just headbutting them. I mean, when Fujiwara headbutts you, it's vicious. He lunges at you. He leads with the head, baby. And so a lot of just great fun Fujiwara stuff. Oh, the body shots from Fujiwara. Oh, it's just thrilling Fujiwara offense. That is just so much fun. He even hits a fisherman suplex in this match. I hate the term carry job, but, like, you know, if the shoe fits, kind of wear it in this match. This is Fujiwara just using his ungodly charisma to really carry this match. There's, like, another great, like, moment where, like, Yamazaki throws this, like, crazy spin wheel kick that barely connects, if at all, and Fujiwara just looks at him like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, it's just like these great, like, Fujiwara facial expressions too. But in fairness to Yamazaki, this is because I really was not understanding his strategy, and I now realize he was throwing an axe kick as a feint to set up the roundhouse kick, and he finally does connect that. And Yamazaki, basically in UWF Reborn, since Sayama Tiger Mask isn't in the promotion, Yamazaki's basically their fourth guy underneath Takada and Maeda. So he's a big deal. Definitely, like, I would say he's, like, the top, like, right below the main eventers, top mid-carder. So no joke. So when he does finally connect, you know, Fujiwara definitely sells it. And is all about, like, Fujiwara is great at that labored breathing. He breathes so heavily. I love that aspect of watching him. And you start to see Yamazaki kind of spook Fujiwara with some of the kicks. And that's when I love when this to me is, like, what great psychology is when you tap into that fight or flight mechanism. And I think you've talked about this a couple times, when you kind of get spooked, you kind of get rocked, or you feel like the match is slipping away and you just roar back into it, you know, big body shots. And you know, and Fujiwara has that cocky element to him that just, and what makes it better is, like, he can back it up too. And so it's just great. And then the ending is just raucous mayhem, insane firefight. Yamazaki headbutts, brutal headbutt. and this bloodies Fujiwara in the mouth, and now shit is on. And Fujiwara is this Yamazaki seeking missile with his fucking head, and he cracks Yamazaki as hard as he can under the eye with his own head and draws blood for a TKO victory. I mean, it's fucking primal. This is, oh, yeah. So I know, and I bring this up a lot in the WCW but a podcast, but I just wanted to bring it up here. Psychology is a lot more than just limb work or like, oh, yeah, like absolutely. Psychology. Like psychology is, oh, I was in control of this match, and all of a sudden this guy kicked me in the head, kind of rocked me. I need to get my ass in gear. That's psychology. Anytime there's critical thought in the emotional response or logical response of a person, that is psychology. Mm-hmm. And Fujiwara, just every time, yeah, it's like almost like Yamazaki couldn't win because either he was getting smoked, or if he hit Fujiwara hard, like one time he bloodied him, like I talked about the other time when he connected with the kick to the head, it only served to make Fujiwara angry, and eventually led to his own demise. So, you know, 30 minutes of just like insane, excellent shoot style. And actually, it's not the first Fujiwara match I ever watched, but I actually think would be a good, if you've never seen Fujiwara before, good first match to watch.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So many elements of that are things that I like about lots of Fujiwara matches that it's hard for me to remember if this was one of those matches that I watched when I was sort of doing a Fujiwara run. Like, you know, maybe a little bit of context. Like, I watch wrestling in a couple different ways, and so there's times when I'm watching and I'm rating and I'm like sort of taking some notes and I'm jotting things down so that I, you know, have in my little dork spreadsheet of mine, and that helps me remember. And then there's sometimes I'm just like, I don't want to like think too much. I'm just going to put something on and I'm going to just kind of go through it. And so for this, you know, I probably haven't shoot. I kind of tried to calculate a little bit quickly while you were talking. I probably have like 60 to 70 matches rated and probably at least 30 more on top of that that I didn't rate, 30 or 40 more on top of that that I didn't rate. And so when I was going back for this, I rewatched about 30 matches that were at the top of my rankings. So, you know, my guess is what that does is that means that I'm trusting my instincts on the first watch. You know, if I see something and I'm watching something casually, I'm not taking notes, but it's clearly one of the best matches I've ever seen, I'm going to start taking notes. I'm going to start documenting it, right? So I'm trusting my first instincts. They're not always right. There are plenty of times where I've gone back and like, oh, I've seen this, but I was not paying enough attention to realize how great this match was. So there's probably some holes in my system in that regard. But it sounds like everything I love about Fujiwara, I don't really know how to explain all of the things that Fujiwara does well that make his matches good. He's charismatic. He's so good at laying out a match and telling a story within the match. I think you brought up psychology, which is really, I think, important here. Like, to me, when I think about psychology, I think about how any style or any genre, any promotion will have kind of a logic to it, right? These are the moves that put matches away. This is the kind of pacing we have. This is the kind of match that we do. These are the kinds of stories that we tell. And then each individual wrestler has their logic, their own kind of internal logic of who they are, what they are, what they do. And then so psychology in a match to me is, does the match tell a story that has narrative fidelity to those other two things, right? Mm-hmm. Like, does the match tell a story that matches the logic of the promotion and the time period and all those other things and matches the logic of each individual wrestler? And Fujiwara is a master of telling a story that is true to him, that is true to his opponent, and that is true to whatever the setting is. And I think sometimes he just sort of forces the setting to work with him.
He's one of those wrestlers. Yep.
Yeah. He makes you believe in him. Like, he's one of those people, like, you don't have to believe that wrestling's real, but you better believe that Fujiwara is real. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've actually used that line about like wanting to be Fujiwara when I grow up before. Like, I always say, like, as I've gotten older, I've had to move the bar for like my heroes. Like, they have to be older now. I can't have heroes that are younger than me.
Fair
So
enough.
Fujiwara has become, like, it's Fujiwara and this one guy who recently retired from where I work, who didn't give a fuck about anything his final year. Like, those are my two heroes.
All right.
It's like these two old dudes who just don't care and do what they want. And Fujiwara is absolutely brilliant. We'll talk more about him later, so I won't harp too much on it. But I've definitely written this match down. It's one I want to get to.
Yeah, no, and I, like you said, it's just, it's 30 minutes of like everything. It kind of, it's just the 30 minutes of everything that Fujiwara does well. With a, Yamazaki's more than a warm body, but he's somebody who doesn't add or take away. So all the spotlight can be on Fujiwara and you can just really enjoy Fujiwara with somebody who is very competent.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds awesome.
Which I do kind of feel bad for saying about Yamazaki. I just to make me feel better, everyone should go watch the G1 Climax final, Yamazaki versus Hashimoto. Yamazaki is capable of greatness. So that's a great match. Yeah. What is your number 50?
So 15, I think this is going to be an interesting one. I don't know if you even have it on your list because I recently saw your review of it. So this is Kiyoshi Tamura versus Yoshihisa Yamamoto, rings 6/24/1999.
I was waiting for this match to come up. To be honest with you, because so many people, like some people think this is the greatest shoot style match of all time.
Yeah.
So I thought it might make your top five or what have you. Yes. So this is a match that I kind of want to let simmer. I'll come back and watch it. I was very underwhelmed given the hype. Mm-hmm. But go ahead and break it down for me.
Okay, so the reason I saw your review recently is that when I watched it for this project, I was so let down by what I would see because I'd seen it before. I've watched it a couple times. So kind of the progression is the first time I watched this when I was doing my dive into shoot and everybody hyped this up, I thought it was great. I probably had it in my top 50 on my greatest match ever. And at the end of the day, like, you know, I don't know if you feel this way, but every time I submit that list, I immediately feel like I made a few mistakes. Like, immediately there are a few things that I wish I'd fixed, but we do it every year, so it doesn't matter. So my first thought was I was too low on it. So then I moved it up a little bit, and it didn't end up jumping quite as high as I thought, but still pretty high. It finished really well. I think in the top 30. And I kind of felt
maybe top 30 of all time.
Yeah,
all that's the different promotions. I just want our listeners to know, like, that's how great people think this match. Like, that's not uncommon for people to think this way about this match.
And so after submitting the first ballot, I thought this might be the best shoot match ever, and I underrated it, so I moved it up. And then I thought, I might be a little high on it now. Like, now I want to move it back a little bit. And then I watched it this time, and I don't know what it was. I kind of racked my brain a little bit. I don't know what made me see it in such a different way these multiple times watching this. So I'll say this about the match, because I'm going to end up talking more about things I don't like, but only because it's hyped and it's a great match. And, like, it's odd that I even have it at 15 versus 5. Like, it probably did start at like 5 for me, and then it fell. And it's got a super hot start. So Tamura smacks Yamamoto in the face before the bell, and they get right to it. It's got, to me, one of the best extended home stretches of all time. An absolutely frantic, violent exchange that I think really holds up. It's one of the best home stretches. But the problem is I was not captivated by the grappling and the exchanges in the middle like I had been, and I didn't feel like the finish left me feeling a little flat. The draw left me feeling flat given everything that they put into that home stretch. So I think, like, Yamamoto, as you said, is sort of this like kind of flash grappler.
Yeah.
He he can feel a little clunky in his exchanges. Again, compared to Tamura, like, he's still better than 99% of people who would ever try this, but he can feel a little clunky next to somebody like Han or Tamura. And I think that kind of comes out in this match. They do this thing where he's throwing these really light body shots when he's on top. The idea is, what it does is it sets up that it's, I think what they're trying to get across is it's insulting and like, you know, maybe it takes a little out of it. It's more insulting and kind of humiliating, but then it sets up these like much harder shots from very similar positions later. So I get the logic of it. I get why they did it, why they built it in. But what it took away is the urgency in the rest of the match.
Yes.
Juxtaposed to everything else, to the start, to the finish, it felt flat. Like, if it weren't next to these other really heated exchanges, it might not feel that way. But in this particular context, it didn't do much for me. And it's been a long time since I've had a match that I was really, really high on feel really disappointing. It's usually quite the opposite. Usually there are matches that, like, I don't get quite as much as other people. We'll actually talk about one of those later. And then I like something finally clicks and I love it.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of the exact opposite. And I don't really know what to make of it. It's still great. It's still my number 15 shoot match.
Yeah.
I don't know if it makes my list next year. I don't know. You know, this is not a greatest match ever list podcast, so I don't harp too much on that. But there's just this gap in the middle that is, to me, very, very good, but not elite. And that, and the fact that it goes to this draw that doesn't feel like it matches the body of the match or matches the best parts of the match. There's an unevenness to this that makes me not feel the way I had before and makes me certainly not feel what other people are seeing in it.
Yeah, I mean, what I want to do, because I am low on this match, is just I just want to make sure that the audience really understands that it is a big deal to be low on this match if you're in the shoot style bubble. Charles, aka Loss, who watched pretty much every major 90s match from anywhere in the world, did a top 500 matches of the 90s countdown on Place to Be Nation. This was number 2 overall. That's what we're talking about when we talk about this match, just to give people sort of an understanding of like how vaunted this match is. For me, it's interesting. Like I said, a lot of these matches are fuzzy, recollection's not there. And for a match that didn't make my list, this one's as vivid as if I watched it yesterday. I can – those dinky little punches, man. I get the psychology. I wrote in the review, look, guys, if you read this review, I'm going to explain the psychology. Don't explain to me the psychology. I got it. It sucks. Like, I didn't like it. The thing is, I'm always here for an open mind. If I watch it again, maybe the punches will work for me. I think it's interesting because you brought something up that I didn't think about before. It's very un-rings is probably what my issue is with it. If it's WWF or WCW, maybe that's a cool cocky heel thing to do. And I can – all right, yeah, he's showing up the baby face. What a dick. You know, I can't wait for him to get his comeuppance. It's just so unrings is maybe the issue. Did you bring up the yellow card also?
No, I didn't.
So this is – I want to say Rings goes full shoot in 2000. So this is like 6 months before maybe their last worked match. This might be one of their last worked matches ever. I don't know. They've incorporated this yellow card. And so all of a sudden, you know, Yamamoto finally snaps after all these dinky little punches and he gets a yellow card. It feels like, oh, that just kind of existed to get the yellow card over. Some people were saying that Yamamoto and Tamura have legitimate shoot heat between each other. I don't know, you know, just personalities probably just rubbing each other the wrong way. Also, it could just be, you know, the way Japanese wrestling is structured, you know, there's a top foreigner and a top native. Mm-hmm. Could just be that sort of rivalry to be the top native type of thing.
Yeah.
I say this at the end. For anybody else, this is a great match. I actually love their 98 match. I think they had a really good match in 1998. the slap at the beginning you bring up is really great. I said this, a terrible draw finish, but there is some excitement that I have. You know, apparently I really liked the Shotei. I don't remember this, but it was like a big Shotei. I was excited. Yamamoto slaps the taste out of his mouth. I mean, there is good stuff that I really enjoy. Next knockdown wins. I have that with 4 exclamation points afterwards.
Yeah.
I must have been really excited for the next knockdown at that point and for them to both fall down and go to a draw. Yeah, that now I'm reading my full review. Yeah, so I can understand where I'm not too thrilled with the finish either. So bad finish, the dinky little punches. That's the most controversial part of the match. Either you dig it or you don't, right? And I don't. But yeah, you know, it's a very famous match. I'm glad you had it on your list because it's I don't feel like we would do this podcast and subject justice if we didn't talk about this match. That's how important this match is.
For sure. It's, you know, and that's the thing. It's like it's almost unfair because we'll harp on the negatives of this match more than the positives, because I still obviously think it's a very, very good to great, excellent match. Like, I don't know how else to say it. But in these sort of ways, we're sort of analyzing and nitpicking and talking about what we prefer, what we would recommend of our own tastes. It's those negatives that have to be kind of justified. Like, you sort of have to, the burden of proof is on almost us for not having it one or two,
to
talk about it. So again, great match. I would recommend everybody watch it. And I will probably have to watch this again in the next year, because I will need to see, is it just this particular time that for whatever reason it didn't grab me? Or have I sort of shifted my taste? Did I see something I didn't see before? Those little punches, I don't know if they didn't bother me before. I can't imagine that I would have liked them at any point, just knowing myself. But yep, they really took me out of it. And I am happy that other people love this match the way that they do. I still think it has lots to offer. And again, there is a stretch of this match that is as good as any wrestling you'll ever see.
Yep.
It's just juxtaposed to the other parts of the match. It loses a little bit of steam for me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to shout out some positive reviews. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But, like, I mean, the guy after me who posted on Pro Wrestling Only, 5 stars, unbelievable match, perfect from bell to bell. So, I mean, you know, there's people who – Pete F3, who I know does not like shoot style, said it's one of the best rings matches of all time. And it's a top 5 match of the year contender for 99. But on our side, Phil Schneider didn't think it was that great. He said he's in the middle, you know, like this more than Eric. Eric's one of his buddies at Segunda Caída. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it seems like the Segunda Caída guys weren't as into it as some other people. So it's interesting, you know, Microstatistics, who is I consider a very hard grader, gave this 5 stars. I think he considers this top 3 match of all time or something. So it's just, you know, it just really varies. Oh, I actually didn't know that Chad watched this. Chad Campbell, you know, famous from the North-South Connection, one of the sister feeds with Place to Be Nation. He gave it 5 stars, says the apex of shoot style. So, just shouting it out so people get a feel for just how good a lot of heavy hitters in the community think of the match.
Yeah, it might be one of those things, some things are just divisive, right? And I think, to me, the middle part of this match is the thing that is divisive. If it's for you, it's for you. If it's not, it's probably really not. And the rest of it is, there are probably things that are good enough about this match that even if that middle part is not for you, it's probably still going to be a great match. Like, you're still going to like it a lot. It's just a matter of, you know, is it one of your best matches of all time, which, again, the bar is so incredibly high given how much wrestling is out there and how much a lot of the people who would be into this are watching and have watched in their lives. So, you know, it's a great match. Watch it. I think it just happens that the two people on this particular podcast are relatively low versus its biggest champions.
Yeah, I mean, I might as well throw out my rating just so people kind of get a feel for it. I gave it 4 stars. 4 stars is, like, I consider the match great, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't give 4 stars to a shitty match. So no, I remember. Yeah, it's like you said, the beginning in the lead up to the finish. The finish itself, I did not like, but the lead up, that 5 minutes in the lead up, is really hot. And I think that's what makes the finish so deflating. Is I love next knockdown wins because, and you'll see that actually today, and then in some subsequent episodes. That is like my favorite finish in shoot style. So for it to be a draw with both men falling down, it was just deflating. So, yeah. All right, on to number 14, which you either have higher or maybe it's one of those rare instances that we have it at the same position. It is a Yuki Ishikawa versus Daisuke Ikeda from Battle Arts, April 15th, 1997.
The April 15th, 1997. So this 97 is your top Ishikawa Ikeda match?
Yep.
It is not mine.
No, really? Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. To be honest with you, I don't think I've seen 98 or 99 because I had trouble tracking them down. I might have seen 98, but maybe not 99.
Okay.
So does that mean this didn't make your list at all?
It did not make my list. Just missed my one of those that like. Could have made it if I watched things in different order, probably.
Okay. I don't think it'll take me too long. I mean, it's Ishikawa Ikeda, but it's a different bent than Futen.
Right.
Defense is the name of the game. Actually, it's very funny. It's just topical. It just, you know, sometimes you write things in your review that are make sense at the time period that you write it, but then become funny to look back upon. And so I actually led this review with, oh, Stephanie McMahon must have learned her armbar defense from watching Ishikawa versus Ikeda, because that was during her really great performance against Ronda Rousey, where like all of a sudden Stephanie McMahon is like the all-time great at defending against cross arm breakers.
Yeah.
That's a great match. Like, oh God. And you know what? Rousey was awesome and Triple H did really great in it, but Stephanie, like, pretty impressive how she was able to step up in that position. Yeah.
I was at that show.
No shit. Oh, that's awesome, man.
Yeah, I've been to 2 WrestleManias and they were both in New Orleans.
You got to go to number 30. I'm jealous.
I was there. I'm the ultimate Brian Mark, and I was there.
Good for you, man. Good for you. That's awesome. I went to the 2 preceding ones.
Oh,
and I'm so like, I saw Cena versus Rock once in a lifetime, twice in a lifetime. Suck it, Vince. So yeah, I wish I went to 30 instead of either of those, but you know what? I got to go to WrestleMania. So it's still very, anyway, so defense. Yes. So I think a lot of ways we don't really talk about defense when we talk about professional wrestling. I've brought this up before. I mean, just a couple of people. I like to think that Shinsuke Nakamura in New Japan, not so much in WWE, was a great counter wrestler, great defensive wrestler. Just to shout somebody out who's maybe a little bit more mainstream, just so people get a feel. I just always thought he was really good at countering. Here, it's just that wrestler-striker strategy that we talk about. Ishikawa's, I think the other aspect is that Ishikawa is just the type of guy who can take a licking and keep on ticking. Yep. Very resilient. He usually is fighting from underneath. And it's just how good they are at defending, you know. And Ishikawa can take Ikeda down on will, but even though he's taking Ikeda down on will, it's not like Ikeda is a pushover on the mat. You know, he's really good too, and he knows how to counter. He knows how to protect himself on the mat. And so there's that. And then I think Ikeda does a lot, is actually in the lead, so to speak, in the first half, which is very common in their matches. And Ishikawa does a great job with the throws. Again, that's sort of a more of a Battle Arts thing, is you get the back suplexes, the belly to belly suplexes. But he just couldn't put Ikeda away on the mat. And Ikeda is actually setting up his submissions better by using strikes. And I feel like that's sort of an important aspect of wrestling, is sort of setting up in the long run. So I like that a lot. In a different way, this is how Ishikawa was really great at defense, is eventually he would catch those kicks and turn them into leg bars. So you're getting the countering from both guys who know each other. Well, actually, I don't know how well they know each other. This is April of 97, but They were both students of Fujiwara. I bet they had known each other for a pretty long time at this point. Ishikawa comes flying in with the knee to the head. Ikeda's just throwing these huge strikes. You get these big submissions on the ropes. They stop giving each other rope breaks. It starts getting more heated. And we get Ikeda with the double wrist lock applied as time expires. And this one, as opposed to the match that we just talked about, really feels like the draw finish is like the correct thing. It was just so heated. Both men left everything out on the table. And I really felt like they earned their draw. So,
yeah, I think the thing for me with this is when I first started watching Battle Arts and their rivalry, I was coming in with maybe a more strict shoot mindset. Like I didn't really gotten into Battle Arts. I didn't really know what it was about. I hadn't to speak to what we were talking about earlier. I hadn't really understood the logic of the promotion and sort of how things worked. And so I think I came away from everything at that point a little flat, relatively speaking. I still liked it a lot. I still rated it really high, but relatively flat. And then I recently came across my top match between the two, and I'll talk about, you know, we'll talk about that when we get to it. And that made everything kind of click for me. That's kind of a tipping point for me. And I haven't gotten to go back and rewatch some hyped things, this included, since then. So this is a thing that I liked a lot, just missed my list, didn't get time to have that included in my, you know, 30 something that I watched or rewatched for this. And you know, maybe it suffered for that. I might come out, you know, exactly the same, feeling exactly the same about it. But it was a time where I liked all of this stuff, but I don't know, fully was grasping and being immersed within the logic of the match.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so what's your number 14?
My 14 is, we're going to stay in Battle Arts, stick with Yuki Ishikawa, and this time he's against Alexander Atsuka, 1/20/1998.
I'm not sure I've seen this match, to be honest. Go ahead and talk about it while I try to look it up.
Yeah, so this is another one where I just really, really like the dynamic, right? So here we have Atsuka he looks the part of a better athlete. He moves the part of a better athlete. And he is keeping Ishikawa on his toes early in the match. There's really slick, urgent grappling early that is sort of punctuated by some signature headbutts that you often see in Battle Arts that look brutal and awful and all of that. The dynamic works throughout this match and kind of holds everything together, that Ishikawa is trying to keep up with the grappling and the speed and athleticism of Atsuka, and he just keeps coming. He's like a horror movie villain in a weird way.
Oh, I love that.
He just will not stop. And eventually, you know, Atsuka just gets worn down by it. Even though he is this freak athlete, you know, looks like this freak athlete, he's built like one. There's great strike exchanges. This is one of those matches where they work something like the big spin in really well, where it's such a pro wrestling thing, but it doesn't feel out of place here. It still feels like it's within the ethos of the shoot promotion. And to me, the ending is what really gets me here. The ending is the thing that kind of punctuates this and puts it in this right at the edge of, you know, kind of everything here, maybe like 11 through 14 kind of are battling it out for these spots really close mm-hmm. together for me. The ending puts it in that tier to me. So there are these just like desperation dragon suplexes, tiger suplexes that look like they're, again, one part desperation, one part attempted murder. They're just brutal. And then Ishikawa finishes it by like sort of just falling to the side in exchange for a Kimura. It's simple, but it's effective. In this context, it really feels like it's not a flash finish. It's exactly the finish you need for this, where he wore Atsuka down to the point where he could get this just this Kimura lock on with such control that it's not just about like getting to the ropes. It's not just about his ability to get a sweep or something. This is a finish. And I just love that dynamic. I think everything's just balanced here. Like when we get to the top shoot matches, I often write and will think in terms of the balance of the match. What are all the elements and how are they working together? And I think all of the elements work together really well here. Each character makes perfect sense in the internal logic of this particular match, in the grander logic of the promotion as a whole. So I think this is a shining moment for both of these guys. I really like their chemistry in this match. And I think it's a great, like, moving forward, never give up Ishikawa performance.
Wow, yeah, that's great. And like I love the, you know, the way you described it with the horror movie villain, and you know, and I love wrestlers who wrestle like that. So it's I actually haven't watched it. I don't know if it was one of those things where I wanted to watch it and I couldn't find the match or what have you. But I definitely jotted it down as one of the things that I need to watch. Sounded really good. I seen one of their matches from 2005 in Big Mouth Loud. Which I liked. So I just need to probably take the time. And I think 98, you know, usually just battle arts late 90s is usually better than the mid 2000s stuff for whatever reason. So I definitely look forward to looking it up.
But and the other quick thing about this is, whereas I just talked about the Akeda Ishikawa match that I watched before battle arts clicked for me, I watched this after. So very much like I'm getting it. I everything's clicking for me in a way that helps the logic of everything. Probably overusing that word at this point. It all holds together really well.
All right. So it's interesting how you say like 11 through 14 for you are kind of jockeying. For me, there's a real chasm between 14 and 13. This is when you sort of level up. From 13 up, is these are contenders for my top 100 of all time from anywhere in the world. So in 2019, some of these made it. And then 2020, I had to kind of lop some off because I started including some other things. But that's kind of where we are, we're at in my list. So number 13 for me is Yoshihisa Yamamoto versus Tsuyoshi Kosaka. From Rings, April 4th, 1997.
Do not have this one. Just, really? just outside.
I love this match. To me, this is the greatest non-Han, non-Tamura match in Rings. The way I would put this is, I don't give a fuck about either of these dudes. And that's not to be mean or nothing. It's just they don't matter to me. Like Volkan elicits an emotional response from me. I love Volkan. Like these dudes are just two dudes. It's not like I hate them either. What I think really puts this type of match over for me is for two guys who I don't give a fuck about, I got so invested in this match. And really, that's like to me proof that they are working at an ultra high level when they can take somebody who's pretty lukewarm towards them and just take them on an absolute ride. This is 30 minutes of just absolute exhaustion, attrition, desperation, struggle, you name it, they did it. Nasty cuts, grappling, and just really great match. So the match was designed to be very symmetrical. At this point, Tamura was probably being positioned to be the number one native. So these guys were kind of jockeying for number two. Mm-hmm. Yamamoto, slightly better looking, I would say, kind of seems like a more natural fit for the number two. But Kosaka, I think, is probably the better worker. To me, the story is Yamamoto is the flashier of the two, whereas Kosaka is the workhorse. Kosaka is usually the one taking Yamamoto down, but Yamamoto is usually the one who would win the scrap on the mat. I love the Kosaka breathing heavy. It reminded me a lot of Fujiwara. It really puts over the sort of just the sporting aspect of it. Like sometimes when wrestlers don't blow up, it's like almost too easy. So it's nice to hear that. It's funny. There's some ignorant American fan who in the middle of the match that just yells That doesn't look good in a derogatory, like a derogatory way. That's really like derisive way. That's really bizarre. And also just kind of weird that there's this like guy who speaks perfect like American English in like this match, at this match. But anyways, so Yamamoto was focused mostly on toe holds. And my favorite sequence of the match was Kosaka had a side mount, double top wrist lock, which Yamamoto beautifully turned into a deep head scissors and then from there into a body scissors. But he left his feet dangling, and how we talked about with the Volcan, Kosaka crosses his ankles in that body scissors to force the break. And it's like you say, they kind of leave themselves enough rope to hang themselves so that they can get out of the hold in a way and keep the match going.
Yeah.
And I love those cool little details. And as you watch more and more rings, you get to see it. And it's almost I've always thought it's very weird when people are like, oh, I can predict what's going to happen next. Well, I get kind of excited. Like, oh, he's leaving his ankles there. Cross them, you know, break, you know, put pressure on him. And so it's cool when it happens. To me, probably the coolest move of the match was, Yamamoto uses what only I can describe as like a short leg scissors, which is like the short arm scissors, which we found out in episode one of this, that that's also called the bicep slicer. So maybe this is the calf slicer, which actually, yeah. I guess it kind of looks like
calf AJ slicer, Styles. Calf moves. Slicer is a yeah. thing. Sucks.
Yeah. I bet. I kind of like, as I'm picturing in my head, kind of, it's like the inverted version of AJ Styles. Yeah, yeah, I don't know if he's, yeah, you know, the calf, which yeah. he calls also, I think, the calf slicer.
Yeah,
right?
He does.
That I thought that was cool. The finish is really good. Yamamoto connects with a vicious knee that draws blood from Kosaka's face, right above the eyebrow. And so you get this war of attrition, the great exhaustion selling, and now you got the blood. So it's taken up a notch. And you don't, I mean, rings definitely has its moments with stand-up, but to me, rings is definitely more of a grappling style promotion. So it's kind of like interesting when that happens, when all of a sudden you get the when you get the blood. Also, I don't know if it's really exhaustion selling if you're both actually exhausted, because like, this is a pretty insane cardio workout. And like I said, it goes a full 30 minutes and they don't fucking stop. So at this point, Yamamoto has drawn blood. Kosaka sees his own blood, becomes angry. This engages fight or flight. He chooses fight because he's all fucking man. He roars back. And the stand-up just goes crazy. It's desperation. They're just wailing on each other. It's this awesome mix of exhaustion. You can tell they're tired and their strikes look tired, but at the same time, they don't want to lose and they're pissed. And it's just great. Kosaka throws this kick to Yamamoto's side that crumples him. And it's just a great, I love when they do the crumple cell on the knockdown. So good. And Kosaka returns the favor. He bloodies Yamamoto's eye. And we're left with Yamamoto trying to break the clasp of Kosaka's hands on a cross armbreaker attempt for a draw. To me, this is probably the best draw finish of all time, probably anywhere in the world. I just felt like this is the type of match where I didn't want to see either man lose. Like, you know, when people talk about in real sports, like, oh my God, both teams are playing so well, like neither team deserves to lose. That's how I felt about this match. So symmetrical. Both men left everything they had in the ring, on the canvas, and just poured their hearts into this match. And it was terrific.
Yeah. I think this was one of the first shoot matches I watched. And so to me, like kind of when I watch something and obviously the mindset that I'm in and how much I understand is kind of important to where it lands on things.
Yeah.
And so it's a match that I wonder if I will like it more in the future. I wonder if I'll get more out of it. I think my problem is I might be just low on Yamamoto. I might just.
Some people don't like him. Yeah.
It's not that I don't like him, obviously, but he might just be that he doesn't resonate as much with me as he does other people. And because I'm hearing you talk about it, I'm like, yep, I remember that. It's all awesome. I just think it might not have been as awesome to me. And it might just come down to taste. But it might be, you know, it might also be that I was watching it pretty early in my shoot days and I have a little bit more appreciation for some of these things. I'm interested to hear you say that it's your favorite draw.
Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
I would say so. I mean, I'm saying that off the cuff. I'm trying to think if there's anything, but, you know, I might be wrong.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's, like, the most appropriate match to have a draw finish. There might be better draws. Like, all right, Curt Hennig versus Nick Bockwinkel is a better match, but I think that match could have also had Bockwinkel or Hennig go over, and it would still be great. Like, this match, I actually think if it had a victor, wouldn't be as good as if it had a draw finish.
Gotcha. Makes sense. Great match.
Yeah, not to sound too pretentious, but I don't know another way to say this. I watched this pretty late into my, like, I at this point I've become a pretty seasoned shoot style watcher, and I do feel like this is pretty advanced shoot style. It's 30 minutes. There's only so many toe holds and grappling, and it is very rings. It's the stand up, take down, scramble, holds, grapple, probably a rope break, reset, stand up, rinse, rather repeat. So if this is your first rings match, I don't know. I don't know if this is your best way to enter rings is what I would say.
I'd be interested to see how I feel about it next time I get around to it. But, you know, it's either that or it's just, you know, maybe a resonance with Yamamoto. I think those are one of those two things.
Yep, for sure, man. What's your number 13?
So my number 13 is Akira Maeda versus Nobuhiko Takada. This is the 11-10-1988 match.
Ah, yes. Okay, I'm glad you had this. This is the other match that everyone raves about.
Yeah.
That I'm lukewarm on. So
okay. So this one also fell a little bit for me, right? So not quite as much as the Tamura Yamamoto match, but it fell a little bit on this go. A lot of the same kind of issues, to be perfectly honest. It's got moments of absolute brilliance. I think the home stretch and actually the finish, the actual finish of this match, are all absolutely fantastic. Really, really top stuff. It's just maybe a little bit of the build. I think this match exposes Takada's, I don't want to say like limitations in terms of his grappling, but in terms of his shoot wrestling grappling, it can be a little looser, a little stiff. Compared to some of his peers, you know, obviously put it that right next to something again, like Volkan. Nobody else is Volkan, but Takada is more of a striker. I think that's his biggest strike.
I like his kicking.
Yeah.
The backlash against Takada, sorry for interrupting, the backlash against Takada has definitely become overstated. He's not the greatest at the style. I understand that, yes, at that time, because he was the most prominent, most famous of them all, that he probably got put on a pedestal. But I think people have knocked him too far down. He is still a great wrestler.
Yeah. And again, to the point, we'll talk about it more later, he's also really good at making it a legible style for those who might be more into pro wrestling.
That's true.
He makes it a digestible, he gives us a very digestible version of shoot. And so we get a lot of that here, and I think we get that in the last third of the match especially. But the two things I really still love about this match that keep it, you know, obviously my top 13, one, the early grappling is a little bit meticulous. It could drag just a touch for me. It's still all quite good, but they're not the slickest, and they might stick around on the ground a little long given their strengths. But what they do, particularly in Maeda, is they use sort of the way they explode into some submissions, the way they grab things kind of out of nowhere, really lays in the urgency and the fact this could end at any time. These are dangerous men that could end this at any time. So Maeda's fishing for that Kimura a lot early in the match. He uses it as a takedown, I believe, early, and he's really fishing for it a few times from the bottom. And he grabs a couple arm bars, different ways of implementing the arm bar. I think he gets kind of a Fujiwara style arm bar at one point that kind of comes out of nowhere and makes it feel like, oh, there's some danger here. The other thing is just the way they use the rope breaks and knockdowns in this at the end to tell the story is fantastic. So if I'm not mistaken, in this, a rope break and a knockdown count the same, and you have five before it's over.
Yep.
So the home stretch of this match, they've really built the urgency, they've built the danger, they've built their malice towards one another really well throughout the match, despite kind of maybe a slightly slower start than I would have loved. But Takada is behind, and he's kind of behind big at this time. Mm-hmm. I think he's down by 3, if my notes are correct, if I'm remembering. So
he is down 4-1. Yep.
Yeah.
So next knockdown.
So if he gets knocked down or uses a rope break, he's done.
Yep.
So that creates like a lot of tension in this match, and I think they use it really well here, because then he starts stringing things together. He's not desperate, but he's urgent. He knows he can't mess up, and he kind of hits his stride. And with every rope break that Maeda has to use, he uses 3 rope breaks in a row. With every one, you can kind of feel him feeling the pressure. And he feels the pressure of Takada catching up to him and about to overtake him. And it feels like it's part of a bigger overtaking than just this match. And so by the time he uses his 3rd rope break, it's go time. They're going at it. The crowd is hot for this. And Takada hits just 3 haymaker head kicks for the finish. Mm-hmm. Like, just brutal, swinging for the fences. I got to kill this guy now because I have the chance. And so it's this really well-orchestrated shifts in momentum throughout this match that keep this as a really elite match, despite me finding some nitpicky flaws early in it that kind of took me out of one part of the match, but still kept me engaged with the overall story they were telling.
Yeah, no, I think you really nailed it. I just want to, again, for these sort of more famous matches and more important matches, I just want to give people sort of context in like how well regarded they are. DVR did a greatest other match in Japanese history for the 80s. It's basically every promotion that's not New Japan or All Japan from the 80s. So it was a mixture. It was mostly shoot style, mostly UWF. But there was a little Ricky Choshu had a promotion called JPW. There was early IWE promotion that was involved in like early in the FMW run. But mostly it was let's call it space bay. It was the best of UWF set. And so 66 people voted, and the number one best match to take place in Japan that wasn't either in New Japan or All Japan was this match. It was Nobuhiko Takada versus Akira Maeda. 11-10-88. So we are talking about a match that is generally considered one of the best of the 80s. So very early in shoot style and just one of the best of all time. So what my feelings are, and you jogged my memory, is if you watch this match joined in progress 10 minutes in, you would think not only is this 5 fucking stars, that this is like the greatest thing you've ever seen in your entire life. It is terrific. The comeback from 4-1, as you put it, I'm not going to say anything more than that is one of the best comebacks in the history of wrestling, and it really goes to show you how great the point structure can be. And Takada is just unleashing the most hellacious kicks of his life, and they are just awesome. So for me, the difference, I guess, between me and you is I love that second half. Goat stuff, 5 stars, probably would make my greatest match of all time if literally just the second half existed. Mm-hmm. For me, you said the first half you're nitpicking. For me, I thought it was a snooze fest. I called it boring. I thought it sucked. So I thought the first half dragged it down too much. But that's pretty much it. I mean, to me, it's totally worth watching just because, you know, you have to, when you're doing the whole greatest match ever, the first half's not that great. But you will get a ton of enjoyment out of the second half. I can guarantee it for anybody watching. So,
yeah, I think kind of 2 things about that is, one is that the early, like, a lot of what will happen is, this happens to me a lot, is I think people will watch a match, and if the last half of the finish is hot, it'll kind of color their entire perception of the match. Right. And so matches with great finishes are obviously going to last in people's memory, finish better, have a better reputation than matches that like maybe start hot and trickle off. So this match is, as you said, all-timer ending. And so I think that sticks with people. The other thing is, you know, in the context of late 80s, the grappling doesn't look as bad as if you're putting it up to the 90s.
Yeah, I guess you've got a point, yep.
So, you know, some of the context is right. I'm guessing, like, so if you took these guys, if you had a time machine, you took their 1988 self and you put them in, like, let's say 95, they probably, my guess is, they would probably have a different first half of the match that maybe hid some of their shortcomings in terms of their grappling. But for 88, that grappling didn't seem out of place. That grappling was sort of par for the course, as I generally understand it. I might be completely wrong. Somebody can correct me, and that's perfectly fine. But, you know, my impression is that it probably looked a little better in 88 than maybe as we're putting it up against these other matches from the 90s. And that hot finish is going to mean a lot more to some people. And it really is an all-timer finish. I still think it's one of the best matches ever. I've had it ranked my last 2 years on my greatest match ever list. And it dropped a little bit on this watch. I don't know if that drops it off the list. I haven't even bothered to look at that yet, but it's still in that contention. So it's still in contention for my top 100 matches ever. So it's awesome.
I know I'm sounding cold on that beginning, but that all-time finish is just, it is one of the greatest finishes period in all of wrestling, any country, any time. So And honestly, it's surprising because I really do not like Akira Maeda. Like, he usually bores the hell out of me. I know that he has a lot of fans actually on PWO, but he just does nothing for me.
Yeah, I remember you saying that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be really fresh in your memory. my number 12 is Masakatsu Funaki, our man. Love Masakatsu Funaki. He's taking on, Tatsuo sounds right. Nakano from UWF Reborn, July 24th, 1989.
We're going to talk about that one just a little bit later.
Oh, you're my man that you got that hired. Love it. All right, brother. What's your number 12?
Yeah, so I know you've already talked to, or you already had this one on your list. It's the dream match that nobody knows they wanted. We're back to Takada, Nobuhiko Takada versus Bob Backlund from Reborn, 12/22/88.
Awesome, brother. All right, since you had a higher, why don't you go first? I'll chime in.
So this is a match that I could completely understand if somebody looked at this and they were like, this is fun, but this is not one of the greatest matches ever. I would understand it, but I just love everything about this match. I think that the completely unexpected dream match aspect of it elevates it for me. That might not be fair, but it is what it is. Backlund brings just the right amount of character, charisma, sell everything for the cheap seats, WWWF wrestling to this, that makes it stand out. It feels so different to me because of the way Backlund moves, because of what Backlund does. My biggest thing with Backlund, like, I love Backlund as a character and as a wrestler, but I often don't love Backlund matches because I get frustrated that Backlund doesn't give a little bit more as a baby face, and it's a complete taste thing. I know some people are completely fine with that, but you know, I'll often just watch something and I'm like, just give a little bit more so you can fight from behind. You're so fiery. Like I love your goofy charisma. But he doesn't do that enough for me. But here he's not in his promotion. He's not in his country. He's facing somebody else who, I would guess he probably could wrestle to the ground and stay safe, but who can throw some mean strikes and has some legitimate his legitimate training. So he can't just kind of impose his will constantly. There's just enough like little weird, like uncooperative places where there it's not malice, but it's like you can feel Backlund pushing against how much he has to give in the match. I feel like is it, like, I don't even think he's doing it conscious. Like, I think that's just who Bob Backlund is. And so there's just enough of these like little weird, like rough around the edges places that make this kind of feel unique and fun. Backlund takes some like rough head kicks in this and just walks through him in the most Backlund way. Like, he can't, like, he gets kicked and his instinct is to not let anybody know he's hurt. So he kind of looks like this half concussed guy just fighting out of it. I think I have it here. Like, there's a face kick at the 23 minute mark that clearly rocks Backlund, but he gives no fucks. He's just gonna keep coming. I really like that Backlund uses little things in this match that he implements into his more pro style stuff really well. Like, just slight weight shifts when he's doing a throw or a toss or a suplex. Like, he implements little stuff from his background that I think make. That actually, I think, translate better here in this particular setting. Is he's another one that, completely selfish, I know his career is better for what it was, but I want all of my Bob Backlund to be in shoot settings. To be honest, like, I wish we got so much more of this. Honestly, I forgive the kind of weird finish just because I think it fits with their maybe not intentional but still a lot of fun. Psychology and the aesthetic and logic to this match. So it's a match that like kind of defies me to like it as much as I do, but every time I watch it, I just get so much joy out of it that it blends, it collapses the boundary between my favorite slash fun matches and things that are great and objectively good. So I can't help but love this match. This is the kind of line where anything here or after is like surefire 5 stars for me.
Okay.
And on my, you know, on my bigger list where there are a few, the last couple are kind of borderline. But this is tail end of my overall list, my overall greatest match list, and a 5-star match just because it's joyous wrestling. Like, that's all I can say about it.
Yeah. I love, so I'm like, I don't know if I'm Bob Backlund's number one fan, probably in the top five. I actually met him once. Bizarre human being. Yeah, he was in, I was at Survivor Series 2013. My brother came down from getting popcorn and he goes, I think Bob Backlund's upstairs. And I was like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm like, is anybody talking to him? He's like, no, people don't seem to know who he is. And I was like, oh, I'll go talk to him then. And I'm like, at this point, it was 2013, so I was pretty into Backlund, but I wasn't quite as into him yet as I would be. But I was still, like, totally pumped about him. And I'm, like, trying to talk to him about Greg Valentine matches. And he – first off, the dude, like, he shook my hand, and he has that strength. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
And I thought my hand was going to get crushed. And then on top of that, oh, he's just barking at me. Vince won't let me wrestle. You know, I can still wrestle, you know? I'll wrestle you right now. I'm like, okay, dude. So I just want to talk about, like, your feud with Valentine and, like, you know, 79 and 81 and 84 and all that stuff. Like, but, yeah, he just wanted to keep talking about how in 2013 he should still be allowed to wrestle and that he would totally, like, rip it up and he's in the best shape of his life and all that stuff. Like, there's – God, to me, I think – yeah, again, this sounds like a little pretentious. Like, I've watched so much wrestling in my life, right?
Right.
Like, I just love people like Bob Backlund because there's nobody like him. There's just nobody. Like, every other wrestler, it's like, oh, yeah, you can kind of compare him to this guy. You can kind of compare him to that guy. Bob Backlund is just the most unique professional wrestler, I think, ever. And I just love him for it. And so the way he moves, everything about him is just so different. And it's just so Bob, and it's just great. So I'm so glad that this exists, like you said, just to talk about other people. Like, to me, and I've said this in a couple of reviews, I love Bob Backlund versus Greg Valentine. It's one of my favorite feuds of all time. Their 1984 match, after Backlund's lost the title, he still wrestled in 84, and he has a really, really good match with Valentine on a Madison Square Garden card. I want to say it's either March or April of 84. People should check it out if they haven't seen it. But whenever I watch a Backlund-Valentine match, I always feel like it's proto-battle arts. The way there's so much struggle, the way they pop each other with those forearms, it's so stiff, but there's a grappling element to it. There's so much struggle to it. And I just wish that Greg Valentine worked shoot style Japan. Like, instead of, like, once he's finished shooting with Beefcake, instead of wasting Valentine, who was still a great wrestler in 1988 with Don the Rock Morocco, with superstar Billy Graham and fucking George the Animal stealing his stupid mind doll, I wish Greg Valentine went to, like, UWF Reborn and just absolutely tore it up. But that's not how it worked out, unfortunately. But Greg Valentine would have been another great guy to have seen in shoot style. But thank God we do get Backlund. We also – I don't know if you know this. I haven't watched it yet. But we get Backlund in battle arts in the late 90s. But I don't know if we have complete matches. But I need to check that out. I'm pretty sure we have Bob Backlund versus Ishikawa on tape.
I need that in my life.
So that there is that real – I don't know if you've seen it, but this match isn't really well-liked, and it didn't hit me either that well. People really dogged it because people who hate Backlund really hate Backlund. It's Bob Backlund versus, like – it's Funaki, and it's, like, a really fucking weird match. If you've never seen it, you should just watch it because it's bizarre.
I've seen that one, I think. I've seen it.
That's clunky in kind of a bad way.
But
the thing with Backlund is he's so freaky strong, and he's a really good wrestler in the traditional sense, in like the actual amateur sense of taking down, body positioning. One thing that you didn't bring up that I really love about Bob Backlund in this match in particular is that his solution to everything is to just bridge on his neck. Cross arm breaker. I'm going to bridge. Like, I've never seen someone bridge out of a fucking cross arm breaker. Full mount. Takata, full mount. This not in a guard. Full mounted him. And he bridged. He bucked him off with a neck bridge. Heel hook. Bridged out with his neck. He was like, I've never seen anyone think, oh, let me bridge out of this. It's like the most wrestling thing in the world to be like, I'm just going to bridge out it with my neck, and that's going to be my solution to all my problems in life. So I loved all that stuff. And Takata just ripping him with kicks, Backlund's freaky strength. It's just, like you said, the dream match element does raise this up because it's just so weird that this match exists. And not only does it exist, but, like, it's, like, really good at the same time. It's just awesome. And people shouldn't forget, and I shouldn't forget either, Bob Backlund versus Antonio Inoki in the late 70s in Japan was really good. Backlund can do this style well. I think this is actually kind of a good way to sort of – when Backlund does this well, this is kind of like how I picture traditional sort of American shooter style or hooker style. Like, when they kind of do – when you kind of see, like, a Luthez or a Pat O'Connor – like, I watched Pat O'Connor versus Lorenzo Parenti from 61 recently. There's, like, a certain American style to it that Backlund brings that's a little bit different than the Japanese style. And it's just, like, a cool marrying of it. And, again, one of the things is the Japanese are more proficient in strikes. Backlund can throw a mean forearm, but he's not going to be, like – he's not throwing roundhouse kicks, though.
Right.
So anyways, I agree with you 100%. It is a fabulous match.
Well, and the cool thing is, like, the video that exists out in the world, the clip that we have, is it starts with, like, almost like in the middle of a Backlund interview where he's talking about Takata strikes. Like, I think it's actually the beginning, but it's just the way that that he can, like, just dives right into answer. He's just talking about Takata being a great wrestler and having really dangerous strikes, and then that permeates the match. And it's a match that I think is just lightning in a bottle. Like, it just so happens that all of this worked out in the way that it did and looked good. It could have very easily been a match that was fun, but lots of little things happened where it kind of fell apart. Exactly. This could very easily been just an okay match or even a bad match, but Backlund does a lot of work in making the grappling look good because that's not Takada's strength. And Takada does a lot of work in making the striking dynamic. Right. And it's just, I think it's just on that night, those two people had good chemistry and it worked out. Like, I think we just lucked out that this, it not only exists, but that it is awesome.
And it's awesome. And it's not just us who think it's awesome. I think it's generally the consensus is that it's very well liked.
Yeah, people.
You're higher end. For sure. And I'm like Backlund's number one fanboy. I'm like, oh, this is like a perfect 25, like fun match to kind of like start off the list. And you just like just said, nah, I'm Bob Backlund's number one fan, bitch.
Yeah. I think it's because I don't like, I love Bob Backlund, but I don't love his matches as much as you. That when I find this thing that I love, I'm like, no, this is the greatest thing in the world. Like, everybody should love this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to go into it because I honestly, besides Ric Flair, I think Bob Backlund's psychology is like the psychology I enjoy the most. Parv nailed it. Parv hates Backlund, but he nailed it. He's scrappy dude. The dude just doesn't stop. And that's what I love about him, you know? Yeah. And so I'll just say this. The mantra of Backlund is, and this is the key to all Backlund matches, in case people don't get Backlund, maybe want to give it a shot, is Bob Backlund believes anything you can do, I can do better. If he's in a Hulk Hogan match, he's going to outpower him. If he's in a Ken Patera match or Sergeant Slaughter, it's out-cheat, out-brawl. Valentine, it's out-stiff. So basically, whatever the heel brings in that style, expect Backlund to take that style and all of a sudden try to be better at it. Yep. And because he's like that, you get different matches every time. There is no Backlund formula because he's basically like, what's your formula? I'm going to beat you at your own game. And that's what makes him cool, in my opinion.
Well, and the other thing, and not to harp on this match too much, but the other thing is, to your point about like him being kind of a weird dude, like that's who Backlund is.
Bizarre.
Like Bob Backlund is like, I don't even know if his wrestling character is a blown up version. It might be actually a toned down version of who he is in real life.
I think so. Yeah.
And so you can't fake that authenticity. Like even the best wrestlers cannot manufacture that kind of authenticity. And so even if you don't love Bob Backlund, I think the authenticity that he brings to a match and to everything that he does is sort of really clear and present in his matches. And so when it hits like this, it knocks it out of the park for me.
For sure. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about Bob Backlund. I think I need to do a WWF like with like a short time period, not the whole fucking promotion, because that would work. But like, you know, really talk about Bob with somebody. Maybe I can get JDW to do a podcast with me. I remember him really enjoying Bob Backlund. Though that being said, Bob Backlund had the worst match I think I've ever seen in my entire life. That Don Morocco 1 hour Broadway is the most boring thing I think I've ever seen. So he definitely has his clunkers, but that's part of the charm is he's not perfect. You know, like you don't know. It's so unpredictable. You don't know if the match is going to suck or not. And so it's so much fun. Before you watch it. Anyways. So we're just going to do our number 11s and we'll take this episode home. You might have this match higher. So it is Yoshiaki Fujiwara versus Nobuhiko Takada, UWF Reborn, October 25th. Wait for the year because it's important. 1989.
Ooh, I do not have it.
Okay. Well, let me tell you something, brother. I'll give you a pass on this one. But if we get around to 1990 and it's not on the list, might have to kick you off the podcast.
We'll see. We'll see, won't we?
All right, what do you got for number 11? Oh, no, wait, I have to talk about it because you don't have it. All right, so I'll try not to blow my wad because we will talk about the 1990 match, whether you have it or not, because I do have it. To me, Larry Zbysko always had a great talking point when he was on commentary. He talked about the human game of chess. This, to me, is the epitome of the human game of chess. Their 1990 match might actually be even more the epitome, but I guess these two matches together are the epitome of the human game of chess. To me, this is where Takada has looked the best, is against Fujiwara. I do have one more different Takada match higher in between this and the 1990 match. Yeah. But to me, this is something I developed while watching a lot of Kurt Angle and being driven fucking bonkers by his terrible ankle lock transitions, is that, and I do believe that if I am to go to hell, that my hell is watching Kurt Angle do loose, sloppy ankle lock transitions for all eternity on loop. But to me, I really thought about it, like, what is my issue? What is my major malfunction with this? And I came up with this mantra: the drama should be in applying the hold, not in escaping the hold. Mm-hmm. To me, once you're in the hold, you should be fucked. Like, you know, it's a submission. If you ever watch, you know, I mean, most UFC, like, once you're in the hold, you're pretty much fucked. Like, this whole, like, narrative that, you know, you can just flip-flop around, it's just lame. It would mean so much more if an angle, it worked so hard to get this ankle. As soon as he touched your ankle, you, like, scrambled away. Like, oh, wow, once he gets that, like, if I'm a fan, once he gets that ankle, once he cinches it in, it's over. Like, you would build so much tension. Like, oh, he didn't get it again. They scrambled away. But instead, we just get these terrible fucking transitions that last. And they're in the hold forever, too, on top of it, usually, mm-hmm. which drives me batty. So, anyways, this match does a great job sort of taking what I had in my head and making it a reality. So, a lot of struggle in this match. A lot of great Fujiwara and a lot of great Takada. There's a lot of holds that were half applied. And then what I would say is that once they were fully applied, the mood changed. It became very serious. That's when people started to scramble and go over the rope breaks. Mm-hmm. And then when they were half applied, you would often see like a lot of scrambling also to try to reposition yourself to avoid it and maybe put on a hold of your own. The thing with Takada, we've already brought it up. His forte is going to be stand up. And the kicking is going to keep Fujiwara at bay because his stand up is more of that lunging headbutt.
Yeah.
So the kicks can kind of keep that at bay, as opposed to Fujiwara, who's going to need to close the gap to hit his headbutt. But then again, Fujiwara is going to be the man on the mat. I love there's drama in there a lot in the beginning where Takada feels like he's going to be is fucked if his defense breaks down in the mat. So every single time he has his hands clasped or what have you in defense mode, it really makes the struggle feel real and the stakes are really high. There's finally the sort of the moment where the match turns and really gets hot is all of a sudden Fujiwara hits that headbutt, bang. And here we are. We're off to the races. Takada goes down in a heap. That's your first knockout. So Takada kind of smartens up because at that point, I really wasn't vibing with his strategy. I kind of felt like he was playing Fujiwara's game. Mm-hmm. So he starts kicking the trying to chop the old cherry tree down with the kicks. And it's a lot of – and I think a lot of times when we think of knockouts or knockdowns, we're thinking of headhunting. Kicking someone's leg out is just as effective in scoring a knockdown because, again, this is a point-style match. It's very similar to the Takada Maeda match that we talked about where if you score five knockdowns or force five rope breaks, you win the match. In addition, if you submit them or knock them out, which is an instantaneous win. So Takada starts generating knockdowns by rifling the legs. So that's really cool. I like that because it's a little bit different. And this is when I can start to use a sports analogy. So as he's kicking the legs more and more, he's now opening up the offense to now kick the midsection and to eventually kick him in the face, sending him into the corner. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like using the run game in football in the first half or what have you to open up the play action pass. He's doing the smaller kicks to ultimately go for the head, go for the gold. And I love that shit. Now, again, what I don't understand is Takada, again, kind of deviates from the strategy in a kayfabe sense. I don't dig it. And I don't really have any other explanation for it. But he decides to lock up with Fujiwara. And, of course, Fujiwara just fucking headbutts him. Just like, boom. All right. He's back down on his ass. But I like Takada's response. He cups him in the ear, just like kind of whacks him right in the ear. So at this point, I'll start saying the score because it becomes important. Takada is now up 4-2. So one more knockdown, Takada wins. So now this is when the point system really works. It's do or die for Fujiwara. And so we get a lot of kidney shots and body shots. I love Fujiwara because it's not always headshots or headbutts. He has the kidney punches or the body shots that really, yep. Those body blows can mean so much. Takada does get knocked down, but he's weathering the storm and he's still doing well. All of a sudden, and this is what I love about Fujiwara, he just lunges forward and butts him with the head. So now we're at 4-4. Remember, Fujiwara has now taken two in a row, so he has the momentum on his side. You've seen just the last year, Takada made the big comeback. From a sort of movie perspective, if this is not real, it is predetermined. It does seem like, because you're watching something cinema, that Fujiwara is going to take it home. And I think this was a really interesting finish. I like it and hate it at the same time. It makes sense, but it's not climactic. What happens is they're 4-4, next knockdown wins. What happens is Takada kicks out the leg. And it's this great sell of Fujiwara where he crumples, he falls down, but it's not really a full knockdown. It's not like a knockout, but it's a knockdown. And so this is the thing, and this is the interesting thing. It's very similar to football and basketball. In basketball, they call the fouls at the beginning of the game. Are they consistent when the game is on the line? And so to be consistent, the ref had called that as a knockdown in the past. Mm-hmm. He had to call it as a knockdown here for Takada to win, but it's not a climactic finish, but it is technically based on the rules and how he was calling the match, the finish. So it's a gray area. It's a judgment call. It's a very interesting, like, sporting element to it, like, because of how football and basketball call their fouls and stuff. So I kind of liked it. But what I like about it the most is it's a thin roster. It's Fujiwara, Takada, and Maeda with Yamazaki at 4. This isn't like, you know, we're not talking about WWF in 1989 here. So you can't job people out. So I think this is a great finish that protects both men and sets up the rematch for next year, even if it's not the most climactic finish.
Yeah, it honestly comes down to that finish. It's a great match. It's just that finish kind of let the air out of the ball a little bit for me. You know, if this match didn't exist within the context of the match the year later, like if there wasn't another match between these two that I can't help but kind of put side by side, it might sort of slip into the back half of my list.
Right.
But it's, you know, that match does exist. We'll talk about it, whether it's on my list or not. You'll have to come back next week to find out. But it's a great match. It's just, I think that finish just didn't do it for me in an otherwise awesome dynamic between those two. And you know, again, I obviously like Takada. He's been on my list a few times. We haven't talked about Fujiwara on my list yet, but he's still to come with a couple matches. So I love both of these guys. I really like their chemistry. That was just the finish.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. It's one of those finishes where I kind of hate it too, because it is deflating, but I don't know. At the same time, I can rationalize it, and I like the sporting feel of it in a way. Sure. You know, the ref has to call it to be consistent type thing. Why don't you take us home with your number 11, my man?
Yeah, so I don't think you have this one. It's a pretty hyped match. Naoki Sano versus Yohei Anho from...
Oh, the 93 match?
Yeah, 8/13/93.
Yeah, go ahead and knock it out. I'm going to look up my review. I'm going to try to remember why I like 95 more than 93.
Sure. So this one, I think, gets a lot of hype. It's been a match that I liked a lot. For whatever reason, every time I watch it, I love it. And then as time goes by, I'm like, do I really like that match as much as I think I like it? And then I watch it again. I'm like, oh, yeah, I love this match. I think this match kind of comes down to a few different kind of narrative elements within it. And the big one is that Anho comes in so malice. Like, he has such malice. He moves with such malice, and he has like this air of danger around him. And he's cocky when he comes in. He's got this like shit eating grin. And he's going up against Sano, who, you know, is jacked. He looks like a killer. But when somebody who looks like Anho walks like that you know he's a dangerous man. And so there's this dynamic right from the get-go, before they even touch one another. And as they start to engage, as they have their exchanges, Sano is kind of getting the best of some of these early exchanges, and he's clearly demonstrating that he's there to fight. And with every exchange, I think Anho gets a little more angry and loses a little bit of arrogance each time. And that really helps build the first half of the match, where there's a bitterness in their movements. There's a hatred and kind of this not, it's competitive. It's like the sporting, but it's personal. Like, it feels personal. And again, I don't watch this in the context of UWFI. So I don't, or their TV or their progression of how the shows went, but you can feel it in a vacuum. So the first half of the match is really held together by that. I really love how Sano doesn't just sit awkwardly in positions. He's like grinding his elbow against Anho's face, which, again, like, you don't do that to somebody unless you kind of have some malice against them, I think, you know. And I think that really helps bring that out. There's like a handshake after Anho just stomps on Sano's gut to break a leg lock. Then they like get up and have this tentative handshake, like, we should probably kind of reset before this gets out of hand, which I think even in the context of this feels perfectly fine to me. It kind of takes two turns. Both of them are, I think, driven by Anho. There's one where Sano's still using his powers, explosiveness. He's got Anho in the corner, and Anho just bursts out and just starts throwing strikes and hits some knees to the kidney that were awesome and brutal. And that felt like a place where this great match took a big jump up. Right? So there's moments in this match where things take a big jump up and they never take a step down to me. So Anho is coming forward. He's getting a little bit more control now. Sano's gas tank starts to feel like it's a question mark. And, you know, Sano's a guy who's, you know, got all those muscles. They require a lot of oxygen, right? And he looks like a guy who's built for a 10-minute match and not a guy who's built for a 30-minute match. So his gas tank starts to become a little bit of a question mark in this. The second half sort of sees the reversing of fortunes continue. And then you get the second kind of step up in this match. And there's a place where Sano throws this back elbow to Anho's face, and Anho just lays in three shots to the back of Sano's head, like, while he's internal. Yeah. Like, he just, it's one of those where it looks like, you watch it and you're like, do I need to look up? Did this turn shoot for a second? I didn't know about it. Like actual shoot for a second. So those moments that make me question myself and watching, I like, particularly when it does, when it doesn't actually turn out that people are hurting one another on purpose.
That's cool. Fuck Maeda and his shoot kicks.
Yeah, right. So they really have this slowly steady building intensity that is elevated in very particular, well-timed moments. And even though, and this is a strength of Sano, we'll talk about it later again, but even though Sano can kind of feel like he's gassing, he explodes and still finds ways to string things together in ways that are not clunky, that have fluidity to them. And so I just really love the way they build this match, the way the intensity is maintained and elevated in strategic ways. And I think that they have a really good chemistry. So, you know, obviously that's highlighted by the fact that you have a different match on your list. And I think this is one of the best shoot matches ever, just outside my top 10. And actually at the last minute got jumped. And I'll bring that up when we get to that match. But this is a great, great match that, if you're looking for, you know, the things that I look for in matches, urgency, you know, stiffness, tight grappling, all of that is here. And I think it's again, one of those matches that might translate a little bit better because there is this real malice between the two and their energy and their ethos. And the strikes are so stiff.
That's a really good review. Yeah, no, I understand where you're coming from. I actually kind of forgot how heralded this match is. This is generally considered the greatest UWF match of all, UWFI match of all time. I forgot about that. A lot of people feel that way. Yeah, to me, I chalk it up similar to how you were describing Kosaka and Yamamoto, in the sense that, and I even wrote this in my review, is I don't know if I'm missing the boat because of ignorance. Maybe I need to watch more Sano or Anho and to really understand them. But yeah, to me, I guess what I felt was like this was great. I gave it a really high ranking, a rating. I really enjoyed it, but it wasn't super unique. I didn't feel like anything. Yeah, I just didn't feel like anything really drove the match in a super, I guess, interesting way. It was explosive, entertaining catch wrestling. But I think I kind of missed the hook, so to speak. Like, it just felt like, you know, we haven't talked about it. Well, maybe it's in your top 10, but there's a couple of PWFG matches that get thrown around as being really great. And sometimes, like, the Shamrock Sano match is another one, which is just kind of comes across as a blur of grappling to me, which is, like, entertaining to watch. And it's, like, eye candy, but, like, it doesn't. I guess it just doesn't hit home as much. But yeah, I enjoyed this match quite a bit.
Yeah. Good stuff. It's good stuff.
All right, my man. This was a marathon, brother. So we will end it here for now. We have two more episodes left. We're going into the top 10. So a lot of exciting stuff going on, a lot of Volkan, a lot of Fujiwara to talk about.
Yep.
We haven't talked about my man Super Tiger yet. So a lot of good stuff left to be discussed. So hope everyone has enjoyed the podcast series so far. Anything you want to say, brother, before we sign off?
No, not at all. It's been a blast talking about Shoot with you here over the last 3 weeks. And I'm looking forward to getting into the top 10. So it's a lot of great matches still floating around out there.
Brother, I appreciate that you always keep kayfabe, my man. All right, brother. And to all the brothers and sisters listening, have a good night, everybody. And we will talk to you all. We'll talk to you all later. We'll make a new episode and you'll hear it next week. And so take care, everybody.
See you.